Okay then, Soph, I reckon it's time we get into our course in focus, and we've chosen Mount Compass Golf Course this week, and I'm really looking forward to this discussion. I think it's an absolute gem. Soph, have you played it much before?
Yeah, Ben, it was actually the location of my first ever Varden, so I have very fond memories of Mount Compass, which is surprising. I remember four-putting the first green very vividly. I do have fond memories, though. I love Mount Compass. I play it basically every single summer when I head down south.
You are going to have someone to blame for that four-putt on the first very shortly. I just want to give you a quick overview of the course. It's a relatively recent addition to the SA Golf Quantum, Soph. It was really only born and developed in the 90s. And when you think about a lot of clubs are going through centenaries right now. Incredibly underrated. It is an absolute masterpiece. I love playing there. It's so much fun. It's almost potluck that it came about. So in the early 1990s, Brian Crafter, the famed Brian Crafter of South Australian golf, a wonderful player, he was involved in redeveloping an architecture of courses, and he went searching for bunker sand. And there's a big sand mine at Mount Compass, and Brian got down there and decided the land was absolutely perfect for golf, the scale, the topography, sandy soil, of course. So he convinced the owner of the mine, Alan Bennett, to let him build a course on the unmined sections of the land ownership. So this is right in Mount Compass, just on the western side of the township, if you like. Now, Brian had plans all done up for the front nine, but he passed away in 1994 and never got the chance to build it. Cue his son, Neil. Now, rather than try and tell you what Neil did to bring this vision to life, I thought we would invite on the man himself, and we are so thrilled to have Neil Crafter join us here tonight. Neil, welcome to Hooked on Sport.
Oh, fantastic to be here, Ben and Sophie. Thank you.
Mount Compass Golf Course, just what does the memory of it evoke for you right now when you think back to what you did all those years ago and where it sits in your mind right now?
Well, obviously, it reminds me a lot of my father. And also brings back memories of Alan Bennett, who you mentioned earlier as the owner of the land, the owner of the Mount Compass Sand and Loam, I think they were called back then. And, you know, as you said, between Dad and Alan, they managed to get this idea for a golf course, but it was more than just a golf course because, you know, I think they wanted to, well, certainly Alan wanted to have some blocks of land to be able to sell, essentially to fund the construction of the golf course, because actually the most of the land on which the golf course sit had already been mined by Alan. He wasn't about to give up good mining land.
Of course not.
Without having taken most of the valuable sand off it to start with. So he'd essentially taken, you know, obviously a decent amount of sand off that property and was looking at ways to, you know, what to do with it, and a golf course was
further monetize it, I suppose.
A golf course was absolutely perfect for it. So yes, it certainly reminds me of my father, and as you pointed out, he did pass away in 94, but the golf course, the genesis of the golf course project, was a few years before that, and we actually got to build the first nine together, Dad and I, and so we had nine holes done, and then Dad passed away and I continued on and finished the back nine a couple of years later. So that it wasn't 18 holes in one go, it was two lots of nine, and it was a great experience. Obviously working with Dad on the first nine was great fun, and he then got ill and passed away, and you know, I was fortunate enough to continue on with Alan and be able to build the second nine holes.
Hey, Soph, how about this? Your name's Alan Bennett, and you're thinking, oh, probably not a bad spot for a golf course. And then Brian and Neil Craft knock on your doorstep. What potluck that is.
Absolutely potluck. The Crafter family, I mean, I'm sure our listeners know in South Australian golf, they're all just complete legends of the game in their own right. With your dad, you obviously created the front nine with him. When you went to create the back nine, how much did you glean from your dad and the experience that you'd had in creating that front nine?
Well, good question, Sophie. Dad really taught me everything that I knew as a young golf course architect. And I think, you know, we'd already planned the routing of the entire golf course, so it wasn't like it was a surprise. We'd already talked about all of the holes, so I guess I had a bit of an inside run, if you like, knowing what Dad and I had spoken about those holes. And so it was just a matter of getting to it and realizing the vision. The back nine holes, as you know, go across some of the, I suppose, higher land at the southern end of the property. And I think, to me anyway, they have a bit of a different character to the front nine, with more lakes out on the front than the back. But it was really just a question of interpreting what Dad's initial vision was and putting a little bit of my own flavour to it, I suppose. But you know, the objective certainly was to try and have a homogeneous course and not have it feel like they were two nine-hole courses designed by different people or built at different times. You know, we wanted it to feel unified, and I think we achieved it. The other thing worth noting is that Alan Bennett's lovely man that he was not known for spending any money that he didn't have to, and so it was kind of done on the smell of an oily rag. The construction utilised machinery from his sand mine when they were not busy, and so the construction was a little bit kind of on and off depending upon whether the machinery was available and whether Alan had some big orders of hand to supply to building sites or what have you. So it was an interesting exercise, and I know that I recall that in the on the second nine holes, a young Daryl Seller of Glenelg fame, golfer and superintendent and great turf consultant these days. Daryl was the superintendent, and he had the task of growing in a golf course there from scratch on very sandy, bony sort of soil. So I'm sure Daryl could tell some stories about that. That was lovely working with Daryl, because I knew Daryl as a young golfer, and he was a former state teammate of mine going back into our interstate series days. So it was great working with people like Daryl and some of the shapers that we got in to operate the machinery. So it was a fun time, and I think we were able to build a really good golf course for not much money, and it's. I think a credit to the current owner, Stephen Connor, who's kind of taken it to, you know, close to its potential. And, you know, he's invested into the golf course and the maintenance team, and, you know, they do a great job down there of putting the course out in great shape with not many staff. You know, they're not blessed like a Cooyonga or a Royal Adelaide or Glenelg, etc., and, you know, have 18 or 20 people on the green staff and a few million dollar a year budget. But, you know, they still do a pretty decent job with not as much resources as the city clubs do.
Matt Overall, of course, the head groundsman there now, very, very talented sportsman in his own right, good footballer, good cricketer, good golfer. And yeah, you're right, Stephen Connor and Capital Line Investment have done a wonderful job of returning Mount Compass to its former glory, which I guess leans me towards reflecting on where it was at, say, 15 years ago, Neil, where it really had a lack of investment. How did you feel about a place like that that you put your heart and soul into, and then it just sort of hit the skids, really, maybe 20 years ago?
Yeah, well, when Alan passed away, his daughter Rosemary took over responsibility for the golf course. And I think, I mean, neither Alan nor Rosemary were really came from a golfing background, and so they certainly you know, did what they could for the golf course, but didn't really have the passion, I suppose, in the same way that someone like Stephen Connor, who is a golfer, has for the or had for the place. And so I think you know, Stephen's been able to you know, have a vision, rebranded it as Mount Compass rather than Fleurieu. And I think, you know, while Fleurieu is a name that South Australians know from the peninsula, not many other people do, and so it was a bit of a difficult task to even pronounce it for interstate people, let alone
a local and I have trouble, Neil.
Yes, yeah, well, you've got to get your tongue around it, that's for sure. So, yeah, full credit to Stephen to be able to recognise the opportunity there, and secondly, to be able to have a vision for the place and rebrand it and promote it, and certainly has put it on the map as far as public access courses go in South Australia. And from an Adelaide perspective, it's, you know, I live in the southern suburbs, and it's not a long drive for me to get down Mount Compass Way. I've got some projects down at do a little bit of work for South Lakes at Goolwa and Victor Harbour, and so, you know, I drive through Mount Compass reasonably regularly, and quite often just stop for a drive and pop in, have a look, see how the course is looking, just out of curiosity more than anything else.
We're talking about being a public access course. You are an incredible golfer in your own right. You won state amateurs. You represented Australia. So obviously you're going to look at a course completely different. But what I will say is when I go to Compass, there's so many people of different abilities playing this course. How do you approach it when you go to design a course? Are you looking at what is your elite golfer doing, but also what is your beginner golfer doing as well?
Yeah, Sophie, that's really the challenge of golf course design, because, you know, you're not designing a championship golf course solely. And, you know, in the case of Mount Compass, you've got all standards of golfers playing it, right from your kids through your 36 handicappers all the way through to, you know, your elite amateur players. And, you know, it's hard to put into words exactly how you go about doing that, but I guess, you know, being, as you mentioned, I was a good player, not anymore. I haven't touched the clubs too often in the last few years, but
I'm still not playing it for money, Neil.
No, no. Well, I wouldn't play you for money, Ben. Or Sophie, for that matter.
I'm definitely not playing Sophie for money.
Her recent form. I suppose you're able to channel your early days in golf where you couldn't hit, you know, when I was a junior, you know, we certainly didn't have things like metal woods and graphite shafts and Pro V1Xs and what have you. It was golf balls didn't travel very far when we were kids, and certainly the younger golfers didn't spend the time in the gyms that golfers these days did, and long hitters were kind of few and far between. But being able to, I suppose, relate to your early, you know, growing up in the game, you know that, you know, golf isn't an easy sport, and you're able, I think, to put yourself into their shoes a little bit and provide some alternative routes to the hole so that shorter hitters can kind of tack their way around and at least find an opening to run the ball into the green. We don't usually like to ring the greens with bunkers, a la the seventh at Royal Adelaide.
Mm-hmm.
There's no way for the shorter hitters, and if you can't carry the ball onto the green, there's really nowhere to go. Mm. There's a little bit of an old man's fairway out to the right, but there's not much there. So I think giving, you know, shorter hitting, lower swing speed golfers an option, how to give them a way to run their ball onto the green. They may not be able to necessarily get it close to the flag, but they can get it on the green all the same. And I do remember my dad saying to me that if you hit the ball into the middle of the green, you generally don't have a very long putt one way or another. So if you can achieve that, get the ball onto the green, then a couple of putts and you're off to the next.
Sounds so simple. You talk about that. You talk about giving people options. I don't think there's a better hole maybe in South Australia than what you did with the sixth. Now, I don't want to get too caught up in having a discussion about individual holes, and people who are listening, they may have played it, but I'm preferring that we're encouraging people to go and experience it for themselves if they've never done so before, because it's a wonderful place. As you both said, it's public access. But the sixth hole, I think, is just worth reflecting on a little bit. How did you conjure that idea that you can go right and long hitters with driver take that on, or if you're a shorter hitter, then there's a bailout way out to the left and you come all the way around that large sort of, well, it is a hazard, isn't it? Yeah. It's one of the funnest holes to play in South Australia, I reckon.
Yeah, well, it's, we were looking at that piece of land, and obviously there was a big expanse of wetland, and to be able to not fill the whole thing in and just make a, you know, there was plenty of sand available if we could persuade Alan to part with it. But, we're trying to work with the land as it appeared to us. And, we utilised the natural features of the land to create a bit of a risk-reward type hole. If you gamble and take on the longer carry across the shortcut, if you like, you can get a lot closer to the green and have a shorter and theoretically easier shot. But if you don't pull it off, you know, you can pull it left. If you're hitting with a driver, you can go out of bounds. So if you're going to play the left-hand route, you've got to judge it well. The safer route isn't just automatically easier either. So there's a little bit of risk associated with playing safe, but there's probably more risk associated with taking the shortcut. And then I think there's a really nice green site there sitting into the sort of base of one of the big sand dunes, and sort of cut a big bunker into the right-hand side, which we kind of were trying to create a green side, a little bit like the 17th on the West Course at Royal Melbourne. That was the inspiration for it. And, you know, golf architects are not averse to copying other holes from golf around the world. You know, Dr. McKenzie was busy copying holes from the old course at St. Andrews. So if he could do it, well, why not we?
There's a saying there, Soph, isn't there, I reckon? You know, good golf architects steal ideas from others, and great golf course architects plagiarise blatantly.
And learn from it. But it's funny you mentioned the six, Ben. It's actually my favourite hole at Mount Compass, and I was picturing, I play a lot down there with my mum and dad, and mum took up golf maybe only about 8 years ago, and she's beaten me numerous times on that hole just by going out left and then just dinking it to the front of the green, and I pull my drive straight left, straight into that left rough, which is just vicious. So thanks for putting that there, Neil.
We just utilised what was there, Sophie. So.
I won't get you started on the first green, but I want to speak to
you. Well, look, I'm a bit shocked to hear of a four putt, really. Three at the worst. They do say that the hardest shot in golf is the fourth putt.
Yeah. You've just got to leave your third one stone dead to make sure you make the fourth.
I'm ashamed to admit I did hole about a 6-footer for my fourth putt as well. It was embarrassing. But we got to speak about the second and the third hole, the redesign, which has just happened. Could you talk us through those two holes?
Yeah, well, look, you know, Stephen decided that he would like some more land to develop, and so we looked at that particular area because I don't think we were ever kind of really happy with the tee shot on the third, and so the opportunity came up to shorten the second to a par four and realign the tee on the third. Obviously, where the second green is and the approach to the second green, that land is now houses. So I guess, you know, more people have got the opportunity to live down at live on the golf course of Mount Compass. And, you know, I think all of the, pretty much last time I was there, all of the houses were built. So, yeah, look, what we were, you know, trying to do was to certainly, we think we've improved the tee shot on the the third hole, and the second hole, I think, is, you know, is a challenging approach shot now. So the third is very similar, a little bit shorter, but a better line for the tee shot. And the second is quite a different hole, obviously a shortish par four as compared to a par five. I personally don't think the course has lost too much out of it. And we were happy. You know, there's sometimes where you sort of, if you're asked to modify some of the holes that you've already designed, you sort of grin and bear it. But in this case, we were quite happy to accommodate Stephen's wishes.
No, it's a point well made, Neil. I mean, I do feel like the approach into two was good fun coming over the water, or whether you tried to lay up a little bit short and left. But yeah, the improvement to the third, I think, is been well worth it, which I guess leads me to the most simplistic question that non-golf architect people ask. Is there a hole that you have as a personal favourite, and is there one on that course that you look at and you know, did it give you challenges at the time, or maybe you look back now and you think, oh, I might have done that differently looking back 20 years on, 30 years on?
Look, one of the holes I really like is the fifth, the par three. That's one of my favourites on the front nine. The back nine, I do like the downhill par three over the water. I suppose most people like those sort of downhill par threes with everything laid out below. That's, I think, the 12th. I like the next hole, the par four that runs along, heads to the west. You can't help but have favourites. Are there things that probably I would have done differently, or we would have done differently? Probably the tee shot on the third we never quite got right, and so the opportunity to change that was a good one, I think. Not really. I don't really have any regrets or anything that I wish we'd greatly done differently. I think we gave the client a good routing, a good golf course, and I think golf in South Australia, in Adelaide, has benefited from having a nice public accessible course like that, which is, as Sophie has said, is good fun. And ultimately it's got to be what golf is about in order to get people to want to come back and play your golf course. Say that they don't lose too many balls. That was one of Dr. McKenzie's tenets, that there shouldn't be too much time spent hunting for lost balls. And while there are certain areas on the golf course you don't want to go, I think the fairways are generously wide enough that you can keep your ball on the short grass if you've got some idea of what you're doing with your swing. The other element down at Mount Compass that I think is underrated is the wind. I've very rarely been there or played on a day when it wasn't blowing from one direction or another. So it seems to be in a bit of a wind tunnel there. I'm not sure whether that's due to the terrain that's sort of to the west of the golf course, but somehow it seems to funnel the breezes through there. And so, there's a little bit of a hint of seaside golf that, we're those of us who are lucky enough to play on the Adelaide Sandbelt courses close to the ocean, we get a sense of that. Our Setons and Cooyonga, Glenelg Grange, etc., West Lakes, they're all on sandy land, not within a bull's roar of the water. And we all know that the wind is an ever-present enemy to be battled with. Never really conquered, but we'll battle it.
You made it hard enough for me as it was, Neil. I don't need 20 knots of wind to add to the degree of difficulty. So I'm going to be interested in your thoughts here. I'm just going to make one point. 15, 16, 17, I think in isolation you'd say, well, it's up, back, up. That, I think, can sometimes just play a little bit boring, but I reckon they are three of the most interesting, fun, entertaining holes to play for three holes that are on all relatively flat patches of land and all just run straight up alongside each other. That's probably the three that stand out in my mind. I mean, we just talked about six. 10, I had a love-hate relationship with, but I've learned to embrace, and 11 is just such a cool hole. I mean, you talk about iconic Linksy style holes. I just love 11, but 15, 16, 17 for me, playing those three, I get great joy out of playing those all the time. I reckon they're real fun to me. Have you got anything besides six that I know you've mentioned that stands out in your mind?
Honestly, I love every single hole at Mount Compass. I have such fond memories there. I think it's one of those courses that I could walk you through every single hole, because each hole has its own character.
Yeah.
What you still said, though, each hole is like it's Mount Compass. Like, it's Mount Compass when you're playing it. They all have some sort of similarity, some sort of, link to every hole. But every hole is completely different. And with the wind at Mount Compass, I agree 15 and 16 and 17 are straight down. But I think every other hole, the wind is impacting you in completely different ways, which means you have to play different shots. You have to play low shots, high shots, draws, cuts. I love every single hole. I don't have a hole I don't like. And I was waiting for you to ask me this question. And I thought my favorite hole is 6, but even 7, I love that tee shot and then that second shot.
The shoot,
All the par 3s are unbelievable. You've got a mix of shorter and longer ones, the bunkering around them. Like you said, I always look back and see my mum can run shots on, and so she loves Mount Compass just as much as I do, as someone who's trying to control spin on wedges. I think it's a really clever course, and I was so excited to speak to you, Neil.
Oh, thank you. Thank you, Sophie. Yeah, look, I'm pleased to hear your comments and thoughts on that, because it's nice to hear that you don't have a hole that you dislike, and that you enjoy playing there. And I suppose at the end of the day, that's really achieving the brief from our perspective, from a design perspective, to have golfers feel like they enjoy the journey. And it's a good journey around Mount Compass through the different terrain. And I think I also like the 18th hole. Though it's uphill, it's still a nice change and a completion to the journey. And a great clubhouse in the middle of the property, excellent from there, and great food and service in there. So, it's a nice place to visit and enjoy a round of golf, regardless of your skill level.
Any other projects on the books at the moment, mate, that are exciting you?
Look, we're busy in a few places at the moment with my partner Paul Mogford. Paul runs our office in Melbourne, and between Paul and I, we're working in Sydney and Brisbane, the Gold Coast, doing some work in Canberra, obviously Melbourne and here in South Australia are obviously our primary locations, but we're working all around Australia. So it's business has been good the last few years. I remember when COVID first hit, I was thinking, oh my goodness, the bottom's going to drop out of the golf design market, and the golf is going to disappear. Oh, the actual reality of it was totally the opposite. I've not been busier in the years since COVID. So any thoughts of retirement are put on hold for a few more years.
Yeah, if we'd known the play, we all would have bought a house and a golf course in March of 2020. We'd be very wealthy now, wouldn't we? Hey, this is – go on, Neil, sorry.
No, definitely. If we invested more in real estate, definitely we would be – would be multi-millionaires now.
Guys, this isn't a question. This is just a thought bubble in my head, and I'd be interested in you both reacting. But, I mean, we are in this mode at the moment in Australia where we have this destination-style golf. So we've seen Barnboogle and King Island and Seven Mile Beach is just days away from opening. Kangaroo Island we hope to see sometime next year. But, the 45-minute drive from Adelaide down to Mount Compass to pay, what is it, $80? Under $80, I think, to play 18 holes there. I mean, look, I'm not bagging Barnboogle or any of those places. They are all amazing. They're a wonderful experience, and I've been really lucky to see all of them. But, I mean, bang for buck, Mount Compass, unbelievable, I think, what value that is, pretty much right on our doorstep. It's something really special, I reckon. So if I'd be interested in your thoughts, first of all.
Yeah, I mean, it's incredible. And like you said, the bar stuff and the actual food at the clubhouse at your end of the round is incredible as well. We have views of so many holes from that balcony, so you can oversee the whole course from a height. It's just stunning. And also, you just get a taste of Australia. There's kangaroos yes. everywhere. They're not even fast. You can hit a ball straight over them. They won't even hesitate. So, no, I think it's incredible. It's 45 minutes out of the city. It's definitely worth the trip. And if you're going to stay down in that region, it's also worth going and having a hit there. I think it's incredible. And I couldn't recommend it more.
Well, I'd just certainly reinforce those thoughts, Sophie and Ben. You know, we think of you know, places like Tasmania, and full credit to the people who have developed golf courses on some fantastic golf course land. You know, all of those courses that you mentioned were sort of unspoilt dunes type land. Well, in this instance, what we've done is rehabilitate an old sand mine, and you know, that's something worthwhile. I think you know, it's all very well to take a greenfields site with great natural advantages such as a Bamboogle or Lost Farm, King Island, etc. But to take a parcel of land that's been sand mined and return it to a great recreational use, as you said, on the doorstep of Adelaide, it's a great recreational facility for the southern suburbs of Adelaide. You can get there, you know, within, you know, it's only half an hour for me from Happy Valley. You know, there's not many public access golf courses in the south of Adelaide, and to be able to get to a quality course like Mount Compass, you really feel like you're, you know, you may not quite be at Bamboogle, but it's really pretty decent for, as you said, the value for money that you get at Mount Compass. And as Sophie pointed out, great food and local wines, etc. After you're around, what more could you want?
No, absolutely not. Neil, this has been amazing. I think I sent you a message on Facebook Messenger or whatever. I said, we'll be about 10 minutes. And I'm just looking at my timer here and we're butting up against 40 minutes. So we have definitely eaten into your time, but I think you have done what is a wonderful asset for South Australian golf justice, not only with what you did with the project in the early days, but just the information you've been able to share with us. We're really thrilled that you've taken the time to join us and just share your memories and recollections and where you see it's at now, because we love it, and just great to know that you were the man who developed it from essentially nothing, and it's still such an important part of the SA golf landscape today.
Yeah, look, thanks, Ben. You probably have to edit half of what I say out to make it into your time space, but look, it's been fun to reminisce a little bit about Mount Compass, and it's been nice to talk to you both about a course that you guys enjoy, and that makes me feel good as its architect. So thanks for having me on, and hopefully might even get a Guernsey on a future show to chat about some other aspect.
It was exactly the next point I was going to make. There are a number of other projects around South Australia with the Crafter imprimatur on it. So don't be surprised if you're getting another call from us very shortly, mate.
Yeah, I'm still waiting for the call from the Premier, but I haven't heard anything about what's going on there. I'll be waiting, I suspect.
Well, there's another story. I suspect, well, look, this would just be me off the top of my head. I can't imagine we're going to get anything out of the government until after the election, because you know as well as I do, Neil, that if you're going to do that project justice at North Adelaide, there's going to have to be a fair bit of revegetation, I think would probably be the best word, as in there's going to be a lot of trees come out and planted somewhere else.
It's called devegetation, I think.
Yes, yeah. And I can't imagine that's the sort of thing you can get yourself stuck with in the lead up to an election. So I think all of those plans will get rolled out in the middle of 2026. And then my best guess from there is that they're definitely a Kyonga in 2028, because there's no way you could do all of that work and have it ready in the middle of 27 to bed in for 28. I can't see that happening at all.
No, I think there's been a realisation that it will be at Kyonga for 2 years and then hopefully North Adelaide. But watch this space, I guess.
Mm. Well, we will have a discussion on North Adelaide at some point, because, yeah, I think the Premier, I mean, I would love to see it happen. It would be an amazing asset again for golf, and I think it would be a great tourist attraction if we saw a North Adelaide golf course as a world-class venue. But there's a whole host of things that the Premier has said that I think, geez, you've been poorly advised if that's what you think is going to be the idyllic solution. But yeah, it all remains to be seen, Neil.
It does, and we'll look forward to seeing the plans when finally they drop some.
Yes, yeah.
And then everyone can be a critic then.
Just
putting the plans out for the all and sundry to comment on.
That's always a fun time. It's always a fun time for an architect, isn't it?
Well, it is, but not many projects have the laser focus on them like this one will have when the plans drop, because I think there'll be a lot of armchair architects wondering why this hole goes here and that hole goes there. So we'll be educated by the the questioning of the final routing that Greg Norman produces.
Yeah, well, yeah, my good. I mean, that is a problem in its own right. I mean, people ask me about architecture of this hole or that hole ever, and I say, well, I've barely read a book on the topic, so I'm going to trust people like, you know, Neil Crafter or Brian Slornick or whoever it might be, that they've got a better understanding of it than me, and I'll leave it at that. But yeah, hey, just very quickly, excited that Glenelg's about to reopen fully fledged 18 holes in a couple of weeks.
Yeah, very, very excited. With Ryan van der Veen, who's been our co-architect and the construction manager shaper on the project, the input of Bob Toohey, and obviously all of the Tim Warren, the superintendent, and his team, Adam Fry is his 2IC who came over from Kyonga to Robert Vinskovich as the manager. I think everyone's done a great job in pulling in the same direction to get this redevelopment achieved. One of the things that I guess has been critical to the project is a whole new irrigation system, and that's not an easy thing to do on an existing golf course. But generally, irrigation systems have, you know, 30, 35-year lifespan, and then they're kaput, and you've got to replace them. And I suppose we took the opportunity to kind of refine the Glenelg that we redeveloped back in the late 90s, early 2000s. And so most of the holes, I think, are recognisable as Glenelg still, but with a twist. And, you know, we tried to do more with less, I think, certainly in terms of bunkering, gone down from sort of 100 bunkers down to about 60.
Wow.
So the bunkers are kind of, I guess they're more integral to the design rather than sort of splashing them around with abandon. You know, each bunker had to really do its do its job and pay its way, so to speak. But again, we're very much of that mindset of being able to give the shorter hitting golfers a way to manoeuvre their golf ball around the course. And again, like your mother, Sophie, to be able to run the ball into the green, may not be able to get close to a pin tucked behind a bunker, but at least you're on the green and with the putter in hand. So, look, I think it's exciting to finish it, and then obviously the ongoing work is to, you know, get everything maturing and all of the vegetation outside of the playing areas growing and looking like we have envisaged it. So full credit to the club for having the courage to implement this in the way that they've done it. And I think the end result will be another surge for Glenelg in the national rankings. Because the South Australian courses have done pretty well over recent years in terms of their national rankings. Cooyonga, I think, was up to 18 as in the national rankings from say 26 in 2016. So quite a rise. And during that time, a lot of all the King Island courses and certainly the Peninsula Kingswoods redevelopments, they've all come in, and Cooyonga's been able to rise in the rankings while all those other courses have come into the top 20. So I think there's certainly an opportunity for Glenelg to continue its ascendancy as well.
Well, I'll tell you what, if you can get Glenelg up to sort of 16, 17, then you'll be a champion everywhere in South Australia except May Terrace Lockleys, where the Cooyonga people will be up in arms against you.
That's the difficult thing as a long-time Cooyonga member and architect. Exactly. It's obviously a challenge, but I love working at both clubs and... I've got a real family connection at Glenelg because my mum was the secretary in the manager's office there for a number of years before she married my dad, and so I've always had a soft spot for Glenelg. My Uncle Murray was the club pro there for many years, so both Cooyonga and Glenelg are very important places in the craft of family history.
Yeah, Neil, you're a South Australian Golf Hall of Famer. It's a South Australian Golf Hall of Fame family, the Crafters. To spend all of this time with you this evening, it's been just incredible, mate. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome, Ben. Thanks, Sophie, too.
Thank you, Neil.
With the last putt sunk, that's a wrap on this golf edition of Hooked on Sport. Thanks for listening. Help us meet more golfers just like you by following us and leaving a review. We look forward to your company on the next golf edition of Hooked on Sport.